Kunja Vihari. Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Vihari. Gopi Jana Vallabha Girivarad Kari. Gopi Jana Yashoda Nandana Raja Jana Ranjana. Yashoda Nandana Raja Jana Ranjana. Yamuna Tira Vanachari. Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Vihari. Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Vihari. Gopi Jana Vallabha Girivara Dhari. Gopi Jana Vallabha Girivara Dhari. Yashoda Nandana Vraja Jana Ranjana. Yashoda Nandana Vraja Jana Ranjana. Yamuna Tira Vanachari. Jamuna Tira Vanachari. Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Vihari. Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Vihari. Jaya Vishnupad Paramahamsa Parivrajaka Acharya Stotarasata Sri Srimadesi Bhakti Vedanta Swami Prabhupada Ki Jai Samaveta Bhakti Vrinda Ki Jai. All glories of the assembled devotees. Gaur Premanandi Hari Hari Bo. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. So, Srimad Bhagavatam, translation and purports by Srila Prabhupada. Today we're doing the last verse of Canto 3, Text 21. I'm sorry, Canto 3, Chapter 21, Text 56. There it is. Atapi prache twang vira. Jadartam twam mihagataha. Tadvayam nirvyalikena. Pratipadyamahe Hrida. Atapi Prache Twang Vira. Yadartam Twam Mihagataha. Tadvayam Nirvyalikena. Pratipadyamahe Hrida. Tapi Prache Twam Vira. So, ladies. So, Ata Api, in spite of all this, Prache, I ask, Twam you, Viro, valiant king, Yadartam, the purpose, Twam you, Iha, here, Agata, have come, Tat that, Vayam, we, Nirvyali, Kena, without reservation, Pratipadyamahe, we shall carry out Hrida, with heart and soul. So, Prabhupada's translation, in spite of all this, of course, we have to go back a few verses to find out what it's in spite of. In spite of all this, I ask you, O valiant king, this is Kardama Muni speaking to his future father-in-law, Swayambhuva Manu. In spite of all this, I ask you, O valiant king, the purpose for which you have come here, whatever it may be, we shall carry it out without reservation. Purport, when a guest comes to a friend's house, it is understood that there is some special purpose. Kardama Muni could understand that such a great king as Swayambhuva, although traveling to inspect the condition of his kingdom, must have had some special purpose to come to his hermitage. Thus he prepared himself to fulfill the king's desire. Formerly it was customary that the sages used to go to the kings, and the kings used to visit the sages in their hermitages. Each was glad to fulfill the other's purpose. This reciprocal relationship is called bhakti karya. Karya means a duty or something, literally something to be done. There is a nice verse describing the relationship of mutual beneficial interest between the Brahmana and the Kshatriya. Kshatram Dvijatvam. Kshatram means the royal order, and Dvijatvam means the Brahminical order. The two were meant for mutual interest. The royal order would give protection to the Brahmanas for the cultivation of spiritual advancement in society, and the Brahmins would give their valuable instruction to the royal order on how the state and the citizens can gradually be elevated in spiritual perfection. Thus in the Bhaktivedanta purports of the third canto, 21st chapter of the Srimad Bhagavatam, entitled Conversation Between Manu and Kardama. So, Pritche means I asked him, you, O hero Jadartham, for what purpose you've come here. Tadvayam, and then the word nirvyalika, nirvyalikena, means without duplicity. Prabhupada says here, without reservation. Pratipadyamahe, we shall carry out. Sanskrit is interesting for those who like grammar. Prati, in this case, means in return. Like, for example, one can do something, then a pratikarya means a countermeasure, something like the English prefix counter, like something is done and then one responds, or a countermeasure. So in this case, pad means to go, or also to act. That's where we get the word pada, the foot. It means the goer, the foot goes. So the verb pad means to go, and to go in response. In other words, I'm going to act in response to what you asked me. You've made a request of me, and I'm going to reciprocate. I'm going to act in response to your request. Prabhupada says here, we shall carry out Hrida with heart and soul. So, Swayambhuva Manu has a special request. He's going to ask Kardama Muni to marry his daughter, who is Devahuti, who will, of course, become the mother of Lord Kapila. And so this is very interesting, because in any society, most people get married. And so here we have an extraordinary example, sort of a universal example, because this marriage between Devahuti and Kardama has as the purpose to get the universe going properly. So we at the present time, our portfolio is not the universe, we've just got a little planet. But nonetheless, it's interesting that here marriage was actually meant for the benefit of the world. And since most people do marry, the world can't really be benefited, or the world cannot really make progress unless most people somehow get with the program. And because it's not just a question of husband and wife, they're children. And so if you take the family as a unit, then that particular group in society, namely families, are almost all of societies. So in a sense, society is made up of families. And therefore, cultivating, developing good families is really, in a sense, what it means to have a good society. So, since this is the last verse of this chapter, I thought we could talk about this chapter a bit. And in verse 15 of this chapter, which I noted, since this meeting between Swayambhuva and Kardama is going to end up in a marriage, what were marriages like back then? This, of course, is in the very early days of the universe. And so in text 15, it said, Tata sachaham pradivodhu kama. This is Kardama speaking, and he's sort of in the mood to marry. He's already thinking about getting married. And what kind of woman does he want to marry? He says, Tata sachaham pradivodhu kama. I'm desiring a wife, a good wife, and samana shilam. He wants a wife who is, shila means behavior, character, and so he wants a wife who has the same character as him, who's compatible with him. So it's interesting, there were, even back at the beginning of the universe, of course they didn't have dating sites or anything, but they did have criteria. And so it's not like Kardama Muni said, well, whatever, just bring me a devotee wife. And he actually wanted a wife who was like him, who was compatible with him. And specifically the word shila, which Prabhupada translates here as of like disposition. Shila can also mean character, not to be confused with shila, which means stone, as in Shalagram Shila, which is something in Sanskrit, sort of like Oak Village stone, because a Shila is a, this is not related, but it's just a, Shila means a stone, and the Shala is a very prominent hardwood tree in northern India in the Himalayan foothills, and that's where these stones come from. So Shala, and Gram, of course, village. So Shala village stone. Anyway, here the word is Shila, which means character. So he wants a wife who's compatible with him. And of course, the Manu Sanghita, a big part of the Manu Sanghita, the law book, is about proper marriages. It's not that people just married randomly or based on whims or spontaneous crushes or something. So it's interesting that in the Manu Sanghita, a lot of it is about who can marry whom. And Arjuna is very much immersed in this culture, because in the first chapter of Bhagavad Gita, his main concern, his main argument for not fighting is that he doesn't want to cause mixed marriages. Varna Sankara, which Prabhupada translates unwanted progeny, literally means Varna mixing people of different varnas. And so why was this a concern? I mean, if it wasn't that God was standing right in front of him telling him to fight, it might have been a good argument under ordinary circumstances. So what's the problem? I mean, why is it not a good thing to mix varnas, varna sankara? Well, for one thing, you don't get any, all the varnas vanish. It's like, let's say in an ice cream store, to give a random example, if they take all the different flavors and just mix them all, that means, you know, there's no more vanilla, there's no more chocolate, there's no more strawberry, because all the flavors got mixed. Anyway, that's all I wanted to say today. I want to talk about ice cream. Anyway, So that's the idea. That's the idea about mixing varnas. If brahmanas, kshatriyas, vaishyas, and shudras all intermarry based on who got a crush on whom, or who figured out that so and so has a really big bank account, or other things, then after a very short time there are no varnas, and so you get people who may be intelligent and can study and teach, but they don't have the right character. Maybe they're too angry or violent, or you get a, you know, so-called teacher that really just wants to do business, or a business person that you know, has shudra tendencies. Anyway, you can imagine yourself all the bizarre results that could come by mixing varnas. And then you can just sort of walk out on the street and see them all before your eyes. So this varna mixing, so that's one thing, a compatible person who is. Now, who's compatible in terms of varna, compatible in terms of character. It doesn't mean people have to be exactly the same. One good instance of people not being exactly the same are Krishna's own marriages. For example, Krishna married Rukmini, and she was very sort of submissive to Krishna, although when she was faced with the prospect of marrying a demon, she didn't just sit there and, you know, she didn't shyly, she actually sent a message, like, get me out of here, Krishna. And so Krishna got the message and then came and rescued her. And yet in her relationship with Krishna, she tended to be submissive, and Krishna actually kind of took advantage of that to sort of, I don't know what you call, tease her, and then she fainted. So, and then, the opposite, the typical queen of Krishna, who's the opposite of Rukmini, is Satyabhama, who's very fiery. And there it's, you know, a case where the man gets the last word, you know, yes, dear. So being compatible doesn't mean people have to be exactly the same. In this particular case, we're talking about a very early time in the universe. Svayambhuva is born from Brahma. Lord Brahma is called Svayambhuva, so this is Svayambhuva. And then also Devahuti. So this is very early on in the universe, and there's a universe to get going. There's all kinds of things that need to be done to get the universe up and running. And so he wanted a wife who was obviously, if she was like, no, I just want one kid, or I don't want to really have kids, then it wouldn't have worked because they had to get the universe going. And also we know that Devahuti was intelligent because Lord Kapila taught her Sankhya, which is sort of a sophisticated philosophy. And she didn't say to her son, oh, that's really nice, dear, but, you know, I'm not really interested in those things. What would you like for lunch? So she wasn't that kind of mother. I mean, she's able to sit there and study philosophy with her son. So that's one point about the marriages. And just as Kardama wanted a wife that was compatible, that had a similar nature, so did Devahuti. And so if you go to verse 27 of this chapter, that was text 7, there it is. And this is Svayambhuva. Svayambhuva was very concerned to have a husband for his daughter who was actually appropriate. It was appropriate for his daughter. He didn't want to give his daughter to some man who was just not going to make her happy and just wasn't the right husband for her. So it said here regarding Svayambhuva, that Atmajam, which means his daughter, Atma means self and Jam means born. So one who's born from you, born from yourself, is called Atmaja. And feminine is just Atmaja. Asita Panging, black eyes, and so on. Vayak Shila Gunan Bitang. Anyway, I'll read the translation. So Svayambhuva has a grown-up daughter whose eyes are black. She is ready for marriage, and she has good character and all good qualities. She is also searching for a good husband. My dear sir, her parents will come to see you. Who are exactly suitable for her. So this is an arranged marriage in which it was arranged actually by Svayambhuva, but both parties, the future husband and the father of the bride, everyone is very concerned that it be a compatible marriage, which is interesting. So the word anurupa in Sanskrit, anu means following, or according to, and rupa, of course, means form. So anurupa, which is translated as appropriate, literally means something which follows the form of something else, which is appropriate for it. So this gives you a good look at what marriage was about. And then, of course, going back to text 56, They're going to get married. They have a lot of work to do. Again, they have to really get the universe going or put the world in order. And so Prabhupada's concept of marriage was the same as in the Bhagavatam, that he married his disciples because he thought marriage was good for two things. Number one, it would help many of his disciples. It was a better position within which they could fight against Maya. They could pursue their own spiritual life. And also, it was therefore because they would be more stable, it would be a stronger position for them to preach Krishna consciousness. It's not that everyone had to be married. Prabhupada never thought that, well, unless you do this, you can't preach, you can't be stable. That wasn't the idea. But since he had all these very young disciples, everyone, I mean, he had teenagers, people in their early 20s. And so that was his conception. Prabhupada, of course, used the terms grihastha and grihamedi, which is sort of like a jargon. I mean, literally, because the word grihamedi is even used in this chapter to refer to Kardama, so it's sort of a more recent jargon, because you need, I mean, every specialized endeavor has a jargon, whether it's in sports or in academics or in politics. I mean, you can't really communicate effectively within a particular subculture unless you have a jargon. So grihastha, of course, means standing present in home life. And griha medhi, the word medhi, medas, means intelligence. Just like in that famous verse, what's that verse? In Kali Yuga, those who are sumedasaha, those who have good intelligence, will take to the Sankirtan movement. So medas means intelligence. Medhi means a person who sort of fixed their intelligence on a particular subject. So the term griha medhi literally means someone who is just always thinking about their home. And I mean, you do have to think about it. It's not that you can never think about it. But that more or less is their, as Prabhupada would say, the sum and substance of their thought process. They're just always thinking about domestic life. Whereas grihastha, stha is just stand, to be present somewhere. It means that one is there, one is living within a home, but they're very concerned about the world. They're very concerned about spiritual advancement. And they're very concerned about Prabhupada's mission. So, any questions so far on these points? Gandini?
You said about mixing of the varnas, how, you know, becomes all one. And then you said you walk out of the room and you see in society. But unfortunately, we see that it's within our movement because the varnas are not very well defined. And I thought Prabhupada emphasized a lot that everybody should be brahmanas. So, you know, even though the nature, I see, for example, there is no vaishyas, no many vaishyas, like a training vaishyas, there is no vaishya schools, there is no kshatriya schools. I think somebody now is trying to do kshatriya school. And certainly I've seen people with those tendencies and there is no room for them. So, you know, it's a touchy topic within
first of all, without going into the whole history with the Industrial Revolution, the urbanization of society, the varnas, Europe did have varnas. Prabhupada used to say that because it's created by God, Krishna says, Chaturvarnyamayastrishtam, I created the system. Therefore, you found them all around the world. In the West, they were called estates. The first estate was the clergy. The second estate was the royal order. The third estate was the merchants or landowners, farmers. The fourth estate was the sudras. So the system was very much present in Europe. It collapsed because of the Industrial Revolution. And, you know, I hate to deny you a long technical explanation of how that happened, but so therefore we have a situation in the modern world where let me put it this way: the Chaturvarnyam, the four varna system, is very much a system for an agrarian society. And that's why at the same time that Prabhupada said that we should establish the varnas, he said you should get land, because famously he wanted to go in his last attempt to go to America, and he had to turn back because his health didn't permit. But he wanted to go to Gita Nagari. Somehow he'd picked out, maybe because, apart from all the ridges, they actually have a lot of level land. But he wanted to establish the Varna system there. And of course, one of the problems with establishing the Varna system today, let's say a problem with establishing a land-based economy, is that the entire national economy or global economy is set to or assumes industry. For example, if you have the price of land is calculated according to how much you can produce on the land. And that means rather than just do self-sufficient farming, you do one crop. Let's say if you have animals, you kill the animals, and so on and so forth. The cost of fencing, the cost of veterinarians, the cost of seed, the cost of transporting your food to the market. All these prices are based on an industrial economy. So if you want to have a self-sufficient economy, then you get priced out. Of course, that can be compensated for by bringing money from other sources. Now, if we want to establish Prabhupada's Varnashram, we have to keep in mind that Prabhupada went in a certain sequence. It's like if you're building a house, first you have to build the foundation before you put the walls up. If you say, well, why don't we start with the roof and then we'll do the walls, it doesn't work that way. So Prabhupada first established a very powerful network of urban preaching, which brought in a lot of money. And therefore, Prabhupada could channel resources, people and money into land. You could buy land, you could subsidize, and so on. I don't know if any of you remember New Vrindavan, the Adopt-a-Cow program? Yeah, that was a big thing for a while. So at the same time, of course, Prabhupada wanted us to do it. Another thing is, where do you start? You could say, well, I'm going to buy 2 acres of land in some remote place where I can afford it, and then I'm going to get a cow. Does the world really know or care about that? Did you know that, in sort of like in the remote areas of Iowa, there's a Hare Krishna couple that own a cow? That's headline news. So in a sense, I believe that because creating an alternative economy requires a lot of investment, because you have to build up infrastructure. You're not just going to plug into the cow-killing economy of industrial farming. And so therefore, there have to be resources, and there has to be preaching, there has to be manpower. I was in Prabhupada's room one time in New Vrindavan in 1972 for the Bhagavad Dharma Festival, and the late Pushta Krishna came in. And to ask Prabhupada permission, he wanted Prabhupada's blessings to open the first center in South Africa. There was no Hare Krishna movement in South Africa then. And I thought, well, I know what Prabhupada's going to say. That never worked. Whenever you thought you knew what Prabhupada's going to say, but I thought Prabhupada was going to say that, yes, I sat under a tree and just chanted Hare Krishna. Because that's what he was saying, like in 1968, 1969. I sat under a tree, just go wherever and chant Hare Krishna. And so, but Prabhupada really surprised me. He often surprised us. And he said, yes, if you have men, money, and local support, you should go. Anyway, so eventually he did go, and that's how South Africa was opened. So, Prabhupada often said that he came to the West because the world was in a very bad way, and Prabhupada understood that the only way to really fix the world is to create or reconstitute a legitimate class of Vaishnava Brahmanas. And Prabhupada always said, you know, it's the world has become a headless society. We have to put a head on the society. And this sort of sacred anatomy, the idea that the different varnas represent sort of this anatomical metaphor, where the Brahmins are the head, the Kshatriyas are the arms, and so on, this goes back to the Rig Veda. In the 10th book of the Rig Veda, there's a hymn called the Purusha Sukta. Sukta, by the way, is su-ukta, well-spoken, which also means a hymn. So, and that's why in the second canto of the Bhagavatam, Prabhupada titled one of the chapters Purusha Sukta Confirmed. Because that chapter of the second canto is talking about, well, is actually giving, in a sense, the Bhagavatam is giving a purport to the Rig Veda. And it's explaining this Varna system. So this metaphor that the Brahmins are the head, and etc., goes all the way back to the Rig Veda, and it's certainly all over the Bhagavatam. Prabhupada talked about it. And so if we restore the head, then the head will direct everything else. If you have some medical problem, but your brain is working, then you can, you know, go to the right doctors, you can work on it. But if the brain is not working, then you can't do anything, you're helpless. So what does it mean to put a head on society? What does it mean to reconstitute a Brahmin class? We can take a lesson from Lord Chaitanya. I mean, Lord Chaitanya came as a Brahmana, which is interesting. Krishna came as a Kshatriya because he had to get rid of all the bad guys. Paritranaya sadhunam vinashaya cha duskritam. But it's interesting, and in Kali Yuga, things had become so degraded, as Prabhupada often said, that if Krishna was going to kill the demons, it would basically be planetary genocide. And so therefore, I mean, if you think about it, in Krishna Leela, heads are falling by the millions. But in Chaitanya Leela, no one actually gets killed, which is, you know, almost Jagai Madai, but then they don't get killed. So it's this amazing, the most degraded age, it's this amazing ahimsa avatar where Lord Chaitanya doesn't kill anybody. So, but he became a scholar. It's not that everyone has to become a scholar, obviously, but Lord Chaitanya comes in a particular form, and I mean Krishna comes in a particular form within a particular varna, because Krishna comes to teach the varna system, and therefore he sets an example. So when Krishna came as a Kshatriya and set the example, and therefore he had very important devotees who were the Pandavas, the Yadus, and so on. They were physically cleansing the earth, getting rid of all these demons. Krishna comes in this age as a Brahmana, which means the center of ISKCON should be education. Should be education, because and it does mean everyone has to be a scholar, obviously. And that, you know, obviously everyone's not going to be a scholar. However, we can all work together. We all have to work together. Prabhupada's mission will really triumph when the world recognizes Prabhupada's followers as the real teachers of society. That's how we will know that it was successful. I mean, Prabhupada used to keep on his desk, when I was officially his secretary in Mayapur, he never actually gave me any secretarial duties. He just wanted me to hang around and he wanted to tell me things. But he used to keep on his desk these sheets of paper that had all the... By the way, Shesha was also in the library party, right? I mean, it's one thing, because we're honoring Bhakti Tirtha, you may want to know how the library party really got started. It actually got started in Prabhupada's garden in Los Angeles. I was sitting there one day with Prabhupada. I was alone with Prabhupada in his garden, and Prabhupada said to me, "Are my books in the libraries?" and bookstores. And so I said, well, Prabhupada, you know, I don't think a lot of people are going to check out those books in the libraries because they don't know about them. So Prabhupada gave me a look. I mean, clearly, that was the wrong answer. So then, anyway, Prabhupada indicated very clearly that was the wrong answer. So then I said to Prabhupada, okay, we're going to put them in the libraries. Because that's the way it was back then with Prabhupada. Prabhupada expressed his desire, and that was now the mission. Okay, we'll do it. So a little while later, I had my traveling party, preaching party, and we were in Iowa City, Iowa. That's where it actually all started. And Mahabodhi and Ghanashyam, who then became Bhakti Tirtha, they were traveling in my party. They were brahmacharis. So I went into the library, the big university of library, the University of Iowa, and inquired, and they said, oh, you need to speak to the person in charge of Asian acquisitions. So I went and knocked on this door, and this guy came out, and he said, oh, I know what you want. So I was, you know, getting ready to be kicked out. So, because in those days, if someone figured out we were Hare Krishnas, usually it meant you were getting kicked out. Because you'd be like, you know, where you shouldn't be trying to sell books. But instead he said, yeah, come in. He was really positive, and I explained to him, and he ordered the books. He wanted a complete set. He wanted a complete set of Prabhupada's books. The only problem was the BBT had no process to sell complete sets. So I called up the BBT in Los Angeles, and they didn't even have forms to fill or anything. So actually, it was because of that sale of Prabhupada's books to the University of Iowa library that the BBT had to sort of, you know, create order forms. And that's how the library prepared. So then, for the next few months, basically, I was the library party. And so I was selling books in libraries and also selling books to be used as textbooks. And we're in Pullman, Washington. We got a few professors. It's Washington State. A few professors bought Prabhupada's books for courses. So then, at a certain point, I thought, well, because two of the brahmacharis in our party were Ghanashyam, who became Bhakti Tirtha, and Mahabodhi. And so I thought, we have to expand so they can start doing that. So what I did was I took them to, we were in New York, and I took them to the Garment District of New York, which for me was like a very exotic place, you know, coming from the West Coast. And I bought them these three-piece tweed suits, you know, these really nice suits, three-piece. And I trained them. I told them, okay, this is what you do when you say this or say that. Of course, they went far beyond me. And so then I trained them. And then I went to Mayapur. Our party was in New Haven, Connecticut. We were doing programs at Yale, and so then they stayed in New Haven, and I flew to India. And in India, Prabhupada called me to his room, and I thought, oh my God, what do I do now? But Satrupa actually came to call me, and that's what I said, Satrupa, you know, I started joking, like, now what did I do? And he said, no, it's something positive. So then we ran to Prabhupada's room, and Prabhupada asked me to be GBC of Latin America. So then when I flew back to New Haven, and then Satsarupa agreed to manage the library party, and of course, and then Ghanashyam and Mahabodhi were, took it to heights that we never really imagined before. One little story about Krishna's mercy. I came back from India, I had, of course, dysentery, and I was sort of sick, and I just knew how to get better, so I had my, sent out a brahmachari. I said, get me some Jewish rye bread, peanut butter and jelly, and 7-Up. And then I was better in a matter of no time. But anyway, Varnashram. So as far as the Varna system, it's really the question is, it has to start from the head. Because it's the head that figures everything else out. Like, how do you in this postmodern crazy world where if you're a Kshatriya, you're a Shudra. Because if you're a Kshatriya, that means you join the military, which means you have to work under some crazy politician, which means you're a Shudra. Because you're taking orders from a corrupt politician. Or if you want to be a teacher, you have to get a job if you have a family. And again, you have to be an employee, which is a Shudra position, but you're a Brahmana. So everything's all mixed up. So how do you figure all this out? How do you restore? Of course, if ISKCON was big enough, we would have an internal economy. And therefore, we could have our own teachers and schools and so on and so forth. So, but it's the head that has to figure all this out. And therefore, it seems to me, my humble opinion, no one's going to believe that my opinions are humble, but we really need to focus on education and developing a very powerful class of teachers in ISKCON. That was Lord Chaitanya's example. So any other question? Yes.
Particular psychophysical nature. Svabhavajena.
1860?
Yeah. Right. Svabhavajena kunteya.
Yeah.
Svabhavajena kunteya. In that verse, he says, Krishna says that you can never literally destroy the quality you're born without experiencing.
Without? In
experiencing means you have to act on it. So my point,
That's 333. Where Krishna says even a learned person follows their nature.
Yes, that also yes. Similar. But 1860 very uniquely says, Karshyasi avasha abhitat, helplessly you will be acting. Varnasram provides a person's material needs in incomplicated according to psychophysical nature. Am I right?
Yes.
Okay. And ashram, nobody is born with ashram. Ashram has to have a teacher, like a sannyasi or someone. And time-wise, spiritual progression. So compatibility is very unique or needed if both going to help each other to purify their material need and ultimately make it success, purified heart.
Yes.
So maybe there should be a system of counseling or nowadays they have a...
Well, there is a system. I mean, it may not be in every place official or bureaucratic. And by that I don't mean, it's not a negative word there. It just means it's organized into a system. I know myself, I'm, you know, every day counseling people. So there is a tremendous amount of counseling going on. And so what you're talking is maybe systematizing it into a, you know, some kind of structured educational system. Ironically, and I'm not saying that we shouldn't do what you're saying, but ironically, the present system, which is based more on personal relationships, is actually the way the ancient Vedic culture was, in the sense that people would have a teacher, or in their family. Families were extremely important, and families would really set the example. The parents and older siblings would set examples. So there weren't literally Varna or Varnashram colleges back then. And if you look at the Gurukula was elementary school. Gurukula, and then you'd get your, maybe elementary, maybe a little bit of middle school until you sort of graduate and you get your thread and so on. So yes, but again, the point is, I mean, of course there has to be training, of course there has to be counseling, but it's the intelligent class of people and others also, and even the three higher classes. Because in the Vedic system, Brahmanas, Kshatriyas, and Vaishyas all receive the Upanayana, sacred thread. And so, but they were educated. So because in a sense, the quality of the schools will tell you the quality of a society. A society is not going to be better than its schools. I mean, fortunately, in Alachua, there are, you know, two very good schools. There are two excellent schools. But actually, you know, ISKCON really needs to pivot. We really need to be an educational society. We need to be building schools. And it has to be, when you think of ISKCON, when the public thinks of ISKCON, people should think of education. ISKCON should be famous as a movement. It's an educational movement. And obviously, we have temples, we have worship, you know, we do so many things. But essentially, we have to be an educational movement. Otherwise, how in the world are we going to restore the Varna system? And if we don't restore that system, how will society ever be civilized?
Maharaj, in one hand, Kalo Sudra Sambhava, there's a default.
But we have to understand what those words actually mean. It doesn't mean that everyone is a Sudra. The Sanskrit word, because obviously we know that in Kali Yuga, some people are intellectual, some people are artistic. So it's not that everyone literally has a Sudra nature. If by Sudra you mean unregulated or not following the principles, yeah, people are pretty wild in this age. But we see that when people came to Prabhupada, the word Sambhava can mean, becomes prominent, like Sudras arise. It doesn't literally mean everyone is a Sudra, and obviously everyone is not a Sudra. And so the fact that Sudras are prominent in Kali Yuga, which is certainly the case, means that it just creates more and more urgency. There's an urgency for ISKCON to fulfill its destiny, become the educator of the world. We have to become the... And how did Lord Chaitanya do that? Of course, he did Harinam for the people in general, but he spoke to leading thinkers like Sarvabhauma, Prakashananda. And look at Lord Chaitanya's... I mean, Lord Chaitanya himself was a great scholar. I mean, he's God, but in his pastime, he was a great scholar. And look at the six Goswamis. These were geniuses. These were brilliant, brilliant people. They all wrote books, and they all wrote sophisticated books. They were great teachers. And not only the six Goswamis. Look at Ramananda Roy. Look at his conversation with Lord Chaitanya. It's a very advanced intellectual discussion. And if you look at Bhaktivinoda Thakur, who's a great intellectual, Bhaktisiddhanta, we know. Prabhupada's, apart from his purity, his amazing purity, but even in terms of intellectual achievements, I would say Prabhupada's greatest achievement, just in terms of as a pedagogue, as a teacher, is that he took this language of the Bhagavatam and the Gita, and he translated it into this very powerful English language. Because there are many ways you can translate the Sanskrit words, and if you look at previous translations, even within the Gaudiya Math, I mean, they don't really, you know, they don't grab us so much. But Prabhupada created a whole meta-language. And things like, for example, that if you don't serve God, you'll serve dog. There's no Bhagavatam verse that says if you don't serve God, you'll serve dog. Or that, you know, you have to serve someone. Everyone, that your constitutional position is to serve. The reason it's not in the Bhagavatam is that no one was stupid enough to challenge that. You know, just like in the French Revolution, you have this, you know, declaration of men's rights or human rights. Everyone talks about rights. But if you look at the Vedic system, everyone talks about duties. And obviously, and every right logically entails a duty. So, for example, if you have a right to education, someone else has a duty to teach you. If you have a right to medical care, someone has a duty to give you medical care. If you have a right to freedom, someone has a duty to risk or give their life to protect your freedom. So every right logically entails a duty, but people don't talk about rights, they talk about duties. But in the Vedic system, they talk about duties. And the one time in the Bhagavad Gita Krishna uses the word right, like a human right, is in 247, where he says, Karmanyeva dikarase, you have a right to your duty. You have a right to your duty. So again, you know, we have to explain all these things. We have to explain all these things, and I mean, there's a lot to do to educate this asana backwards planet. You know, we really need, there's a desperate need for teaching. And ISKCON will be successful when the center, when you think of the Hare Krishna movement, you think of education. Schools, building schools, the best teachers. That's the movement that will actually save the world. Isn't that book distribution? Well, if people are reading the books, I think my goal is to bring people to Prabhupada. So if it's actually working, if we had schools and you give out books and people read the books and, you know, are they understanding them? How many people are reading them? How many people are throwing them away? When Prabhupada said to sell his books, of course we have to sell Prabhupada's books. Of course Prabhupada's books are the most potent. But we have to see if we're doing it in a way that is bringing large numbers of people to Prabhupada. The goal is to get people to Prabhupada's shelter. So are we doing that? I mean, and I think we will do it, but we have to educate them. We have to teach people how to read Prabhupada's books. We have to teach people, so yes, give out the books, but then teach people how to understand them. Because Prabhupada's books contained advanced theology. Prabhupada's a very sophisticated writer. He's a very complex philosopher. He makes all kinds of points. When Prabhupada was here, he used to complain that his own disciples weren't reading his books. So we have to not only give people the books, but teach them how to understand them. So before I get myself in more trouble, we'll stop here. Oh, go ahead. Yes.
No, go ahead.
Go ahead. Go ahead, Bali, go for it.
Hare Krishna. It's kind of a layered question, which is why I hesitate. But we're talking about the varnas, and I think there's a little bit of, and this is kind of relevant with what's going on right now, the discussions we're having, a little bit of the male perspective on the varnas. You know, when we say Kshatriya, you think of Arjuna and the sword and the kings, and Brahmana, it's like the, you know, this sadhu sitting outside of this hut doing a yajna, and the Vaishyas are these fat merchants with cows and grains.
Oh, fat merchants, that's
Kali Yuga. And the Shudra is a laborer, just work, you know, right. And it's kind of colors our perception a little bit. And, you know, we're talking a lot in our circles now about the, you know, the female Diksha Guru
yes.
topic. And it's, and I think one part of the question is how to kind of shift to understand the Varna system as is not just kind of like the male
no,
vision
absolutely
or
not.
Perspective. And the second is how we have this sense of occupation and a sense of nature, which is the color or varna, but Prabhupada's focus was like, whatever you're doing, it's like brahminical in behavior and in training, even if you're a shudra by nature or a kshatriya by occupation. So my question is a little bit how to maybe shift the way we, not necessarily the language, but the way that we approach these kinds of topics to bring in the female perspective and relating that to how
okay.
they can be the Brahmins
yeah.
and the teachers.
Well,
the
first
gurus.
Of all, yeah, obviously women have varnas, are in varnas. That's why Arjuna's main argument in the first chapter of the Gita is we don't want to mix the varnas. And he means through marriage. He's talking about mixing varnas. So if women don't have varnas, how can you get mixing of varnas through marriage? So clearly women have varnas. And actually, here's, I mean, so I don't think that varnas just mean women. For example, if you look at the Bhagavatam, and if you look at, people are always offering prayers. The typical Bhagavatam story is something will happen, and then someone's offering prayers, or they see Krishna, then Krishna's instructing, and that person's response. So there's, it's like story, prayer, story, prayer, story, prayer, or teaching. Prayer, Krishna teaches, and the people he's hearing from, you know, offer prayers. So what's interesting is that often in the Bhagavatam, the most sophisticated prayers, I mean by that linguistically, like the Sanskrit, theologically, linguistically, the most sophisticated prayers are often offered by women. If you know Sanskrit, you will see that it's the women that offer that often offer the most sophisticated, linguistically and theologically, the most complex prayers. There are many stories in the Bhagavatam where women are more intelligent than their husbands. The wives of Kaliya, the wives of the Brahmins. You know, it's interesting because in the Mahabharata, there's this scene where Pandu's anxious to have sons, and so Kunti calls these three top devas, you know, Indra, well, first Dharma or Yamaraj, and then Indra, and no, then Vayu, and then Indra. And then Madri, you know, says to Kunti, could I do that too? Because she wants to have kids for Pandu. And then, of course, she kind of fakes out Kunti, she double dips. You know, she gets the Ashwin, she hit the button twice, and she got the twin Ashwins. So she got the twins. And so then Pandu goes back to Kunti and says, you know, let's keep this going. Let's have more sons, because it's like the ultimate collectible for kings. For one thing is because the average lifespan of a king was often not very long. It was a very dangerous profession, so they wanted to have a lot of sons. So then Kunti says, no, you know, what are people going to think? That I'm, you know, do you want me to have a kid with every god in heaven? And so then Pandu makes this classic statement. He says, a woman must obey her husband, whether he's right or wrong, which I'm sure some people quote. And then Kunti's response is basically, in your dreams. And then Pandu said, yes, dear. So if you look at real relationships between men and women, they were real people. They were real people. Rukmini was submissive to Krishna. Krishna was submissive to Satyabhama. And so they were real people. Like, I mean, I don't want to get into that whole thing, but the Vedas, not only gurus that teach the Vedas, but the people that spoke the Vedas. not just gurus, people that actually spoke the Vedas, some of them are women. So you have all the Brahmins, all the gurus in Bharatvarsha studying verses spoken by women. So often it's said, well, maybe in the past women didn't have this or that position, but now times have changed. No, I don't know what past you're talking about. And like I said, you know, it's common in the Bhagavatam that, you know, some women are more intelligent than their husbands. And the husbands ultimately have to say, you know, sorry, dear, you were more intelligent than me. So, I mean, consider the case of Sudama Brahman, that great story. His wife says to him, you know, we're practically starving. You know, your old school buddy is the richest person in the world right now. You know, just down the road in Dwarka. So go ask him to help. And he says, no, I don't think I want to do that. So what happens? He goes. So if you look at the real Vedic culture, not later Hindu culture. If you look at Vedic culture, it's not at all chauvinistic. Women are given great respect. There's the man's domain and there's the woman's domain. Take, for example, Krishna's own sister Subhadra. You know, what is called the kidnapping of Subhadra. It's not, they didn't really, Arjuna didn't kidnap her, they eloped. And so we find out in the Mahabharata when they were fleeing Dwarka, it turns out that this very nice, gentle lady, Subhadra, Krishna's sister, just happened to be expert at driving a war chariot. Just, you know, among her skills, she could drive a war chariot. And so, or for example, in the Mahabharata, when the Pandavas came to visit the, Krishna. Krishna and some of the Yadavs came to visit the Pandavas in Indraprastha. And so it was the hot season, so they had these resort areas. I mean, in Krishna's time, there were resort areas. You know, river resorts, mountain resorts. And so they went down to the river, the Jamuna River, for a vacation. And it said that, you know, that all the royals were there and they were had different activities, so they had a wrestling tournament. The interesting thing is, it was the wrestling tournament was for women. Now, that probably doesn't fit the image some people have of the sort of shy, demure, seen and not heard Vedic woman. But that's just their imagination. That, you know, maybe it's sometimes in Hindu culture, but that's certainly not Vedic culture. So the women had a wrestling tournament. So I think what we really need to do is stop using the term Vedic culture in absurd ways and actually find out what it really means.
How do we kind of shift now? We're leaning in this direction. We're trying to move to in this direction. And obviously there's things that are obstacles to that. But how can we, in a like tangible way, in our modern society, make it so that these archetypes that we have grown up with or have been thrust upon us, they can be shifted, or the narrative can be shifted, so that basically the woman can be the spiritual counselors, guides, and gurus in our society? How can we realistically create a way to do that now?
Well, I mean, I have my preaching project, which I'll remain unnamed here, but and it's actually spreading, you know, in many countries, and it's a total meritocracy. For example, it just so happened, it wasn't planned, it wasn't like affirmative action, or it wasn't chauvinism. We have a governing board like for Krishna West North America, and you know, a strong majority of the leaders are women. Why? Because they're qualified. Because they step forward. They're good devotees. They want to do the work. So I think what I'm doing in my own preaching, which goes on in many countries, is it's a meritocracy. If someone is willing and able to do something, just go do it. I don't care what gender someone is, and what's that got to do with anything? And actually, they're not falling down. I mean, you know, some people think, well, if you let women work according to their actual ability, then, you know, the sky will fall, the planets will crash, and before you know it, you know, everyone will be living in pigsties and, you know, and whatever. It's just not true. It's just, in fact, the opposite is true, and I'll tell you why. Because Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita 3:33, actually, the verse you quote is really good. What number was that again? 18?
18?
Yeah, okay, very good. That's a really... Let me read that, the verse he was referring to, because it's very relevant here. 1860. Krishna says, Svabhava jena konteya. Svabhava means your own nature. And... So nivadhak, swena karmana, you are bound, you are locked into your own work, which is born of your nature. It's not born of someone, you know, telling you something. It's born of your nature. Svabhava jena konteya, nivadhak swena karmana, kartu nechasi jan mohat. So if mohat, because of illusion, you don't want to do your duty. Karisha siya vachopisa. You will do it anyway, because it's beyond your control. Vasha means control, and avasha means beyond your control. And Krishna says the same thing. Now I'll read my, you know, my first choice, but yours is really good. I'm gonna add that to my repertoire. So, in 333, well, I know the verse. Krishna says, Sadrashang Cheshtate Swasya Prakritir Gyanavanapi. Even a wise person, Gyanavan. Now, this word Gyanavan is very important in the Gita. Remember, Bahunam Janmanam Ante, after many births, well, you know it, of course. Gyanavan Mam Prapadyate, after many births, one who is enlightened surrenders to me. And that's the great soul. Krishna here uses the same word, Gyanavan. And he says that, Sadrasham, accordingly, Sadrasham Cheshtate Swasya Prakritir Gyanavanapi, even a Gyanavan, even an enlightened person, will act according to their own nature. And then Krishna says, Prakritin Janti Bhutani, creatures follow their nature. Simple. Creatures follow their nature. Prakritin Janti Nigraha, which means repression, literally pulling down. Graha, from graha, we have English words like grasp, grab, grah. So nigraha, pulling down. Nigra, repression, king kadishati, what will it do? Rhetorical question. So the only way, and then Krishna says, if you perform another's duty, it's more dangerous than death. That's pretty dangerous. I mean, that's kind of like top tier dangerous. So if you do not allow a woman full freedom to serve according to her nature, you are the one that's endangering her. You know, these people think they're protecting women by not allowing them to obey Krishna. Not allowing them to serve Krishna according to their own nature, which puts them in a danger greater than death, and that's your concept of protection? It's actually degrading women. So what we really need is to understand Bhagavad Gita clearly. But again, those of us who are sane about all these things, we have to teach. We have to teach. It's just like so many people complain about the current crop of politicians we have in this country. And so my answer is, whoever thought they would save the country? We're supposed to be saving the country. It's not like, I mean, are you really surprised? I mean, don't you know what Prabhupada said about politicians? The real question is, where are we? We're supposed to be saving the country. And the same is true. We have to stop people that don't understand the actual Vedic role for women from degrading women, from putting women in the greatest danger by not allowing them to serve according to their full ability and propensity. And as Arjuna points out, actually, last thing in the first chapter of the Gita, if women are degraded, the whole society becomes degraded. That's right in the Gita. So, anything else? Oh, thank you. Infomercial. That's my addition. Buy one today, and I'll send you a vegetable cutter. So thank you all very much. Hare Krishna. Hare Krishna.